It's a real pleasure to welcome to this conversation Brad Hathaway, Managing Partner of Farview Capital Management. Brad, as most of you know, has been contributing to our online conferences for quite some time, and I wanted to be sure that we get his perspective on this quite unique moment in financial markets history here. This is on March the 20th. Brad, I'll just ask you to kind of give us your assessment, tell us what you've been up to, and we'll take it from there.
Absolutely, and thank you for having me, John. It's always a pleasure to chat with the Manual of Ideas. So, obviously, this has been a pretty unexpected development. While I think there were a lot of people who thought maybe markets were overvalued and were positioned for a downturn, I doubt that the coronavirus was on anyone's list of negative catalysts coming into the year. So, obviously, this business is one wherein you have to quickly adapt to the new reality, not what we hope it would be, not what we would like it to be, but accept what is happening kind of now, and then try to make the best decision with the hand you've been dealt at that moment. So that has required a fair amount of reassessment, looking at what we have in the portfolio and understanding, okay, which of these companies are potentially exposed to some of the industries that will be most impacted, travel, retail, dining, et cetera. Which of the companies have the balance sheets to survive through a period of significant disruption? And which companies, and there are some, are actually positioned to take advantage of this disruption and actually have their businesses benefit, and try to then be relatively aggressive to adjust the risk rewards, move away from kind of what our prior goalposts were, and adjust the risk rewards of each position to confront the new reality and accept the new reality, and then say, okay, based on the situation we're in today, where is the best place for us to allocate capital? And so that's what we've been trying to do. And I will say that, obviously it sounds better in theory, but the process of making that adjustment is obviously hard because you're working against the anchoring bias of, well, previously I thought, this stock was worth X. You have to, it takes a little bit of mental, it takes mental flexibility to quickly accept that, now all of a sudden, it's worth maybe 80% of X because of this disruption. So we've assessed all the positions we have. We've consolidated into the names that we feel either most comfortable are going to survive this or even come out of this better. We've trimmed some of our, or trimmed and eliminated a couple of our kind of smaller non-core positions. And so what that means in practice is we've, shrunk the portfolio by a few names, but actually increased exposure overall as we've added two positions that we think provide very attractive risk rewards at the prices they were offered.
So, sounds like you've been quite active. To the extent you're willing to talk about the opportunities you were seeing, I'd love to hear about that.
Sure. So, as I kind of said from the beginning, I think there's kind of really, if we assume the kind of baseline, what seems to be the baseline assumption that, and by the way, there is obviously a whole medical and moral and kind of concern for society side of this that I'm just generally going to ignore for right now and just purely talk about the investing side. But from that perspective, if we take the kind of base case, it seems to be that there will be, that we will be able to contain this, that the more kind of draconian lockdown measures will work in the US and Europe as they've been proven to be pretty effective in China and or the aggressive monitoring that was pretty effective in South Korea. Says that there is a way out of this and the disruption will be relatively short-lived, then you have companies wherein the even this short disruption will cause a material harm to their business. And so that's companies either that don't have the balance sheets to survive this kind of hiccup, without either equity dilution or the potential risk of tripping covenants and things like that, or, you know, companies that are truly directly exposed. So, you know, as everyone knows, I mean, restaurant traffic has dropped to almost nothing. Airlines obviously are running basically empty planes at this point, cruise ships and whatnot. So those are the businesses that even with a relatively short disruption are going to have a material impact. And while they may eventually return to their normalized earnings power, the risk is that in some way they will, in some way, equity shareholders will be permanently impaired before that happens. And I don't mean permanently impaired necessarily in terms of Chapter 11. I mean potentially they'll have to raise capital at a lower level, or they won't be able to invest in significant growth projects, and those things that will actually lower their kind of value based on their long-term cash flows in a permanent way. Then there are the businesses that this disruption will really just be a kind of a hiccup in, you know, year one of the DCF, wherein if we assume the conditions normalize 2021 and beyond, there shouldn't be that much of a material impact other than the lost kind of cash flows of 2020. And so those businesses are, you know, companies wherein they will certainly suffer because of the economic weakness, but their balance sheets are strong enough, their competitive positions are strong enough, and their businesses are not as directly impacted such that it should be a hiccup. And so the values of those businesses, you know, should have decreased slightly, but I think oftentimes not as much as what's been implied by the equity markets. And then the final thing, again, is these businesses that are actually going to benefit from this. And the easiest thing to think about is the direct-to-consumer businesses. So, for example, one of Farview's largest position right now is a company called Naked Wines PLC. They are a UK subscription wine service. And so what they do is they provide direct-to-consumer wine under a subscription model wherein you pay a certain amount into an account each month, and then you use that subscription payment as credits to then purchase wine whenever you need it. And there's a lot of social networking aspects of their business model as well. But as people have been less willing to actually travel to retail and have been sheltering at home and getting more things shipped to themselves, obviously Naked has seen a significant increase in their volume. In fact, they actually, in the UK, which is one of their oldest market, they had to send an email out to their subscribers saying that they were basically running out of stock and they were going to focus on fulfilling existing orders, but they weren't going to try to grow the new customer base as much as they would have otherwise because demand has been so high. That's in their kind of historical core UK market. Their US market, which is newer and is a much bigger addressable market, they actually have significantly more capacity. So this has been a great opportunity for them to increase their marketing spend and try to gain new subscribers that may not have tried this before. And once again, the U.S. is a huge addressable market. There's significant room for profit because of the inefficiencies of the U.S. three-tier distribution model. And generally, Naked customers have a roughly 4x LTV to CAC ratio, so each customer they adds significant value. So in the U.S., where they've had a lot of capacity, this has been a huge opportunity for them to take market share and really accelerate their business. So when you look out over the long term, assuming that these customers are similarly sticky to Naked or to Naked's historical set of customers, this will be a chance for them to add significant value to their business. So that is actually Farview's largest position currently, and it's one that we feel has, you know, significant upside and actually benefits from this crisis.
What are their biggest markets?
So they're operating in three markets currently. The UK is their oldest market and is generally the most mature. Australia, they've operated in for a while and is smaller, still has some room for growth. The biggest market is the US, where they think they have room to kind of more than double. I mean, they are, you know, the US DTC market is growing rapidly. and they are by far the largest US DTC player.
Interesting. Do you mind also giving us an update on Tobi, the company you presented
Yep.
last October?
So Tobi has both elements that are positive and negative with regards to this current crisis. So on the ne we'll start with the negative side. The goal for Tobi this year was to become cash flow breakeven by the end of 2020. Obviously, this is not a great time to be a business that is still not making money. They have a strong enough balance sheet to make it through, but if we assume that there is some hit to demand from the coronavirus, their ability to get cash flow breakeven in 2020 will either require a little less spending on growth, or they may have to push it off to 2021. So that is the negative part of their business. The positive aspect of their business is, if we remember, they had three businesses. One was medical devices, which should be mainly unaffected by this, because that's due to people, again, with severe diseases that, like, for example, ALS, that leave them only able to, communicate using eye movements. That business is generally insurance funded, and shouldn't be impacted too much by the weakening economy. Their market research business could be impacted some. That is where people are using eye trackers to see what people are looking at in terms of packaging or on a website, or for performance, like what are the best workers looking at when they're doing something in an automotive factory compared to the worst workers for training purposes. So that business obviously may have some impact as they're slashed in the near term. And training budgets also may be hit as well, as people are looking to kind of cut costs wherever they can. What's interesting about the third business is that is the eye tracking for consumer electronic devices. And that is an area actually where they could benefit from this crisis. As people are staying at home more, there's going to be, so their biggest end markets are computer gaming, virtual reality, and then mainstream computing. So as people are staying at home more, again, they're increasing their time spent on computer gaming. Eye tracking has just become a really big part of that. They help sponsor some of the esports leagues, and there are a lot of Twitch streams that have eye tracking on them. So as people are doing more and more gaming, there should be more chance for eye tracking to gain use in that market. Also, if people are less willing to meet in person, there should be more demand for virtual reality, both in terms of a corporate setting for training purposes, and in a consumer setting, as a good way maybe to interact with your friends, while not physically present. Obviously, that's kind of more of a long-term thing. But eye tracking is critical for both training and social uses in virtual reality, because it makes the virtual reality goggle much more effective. So one of the problems with virtual reality right now is, if you know how the eye works, the eye really only precisely renders things at the center of your vision, and stuff around the periphery of your vision is rendered at a much lower, is much less precise. So the problem for virtual reality goggles is, if they don't know what you're looking at, they have to render the entire field of vision at the utmost, at the highest quality. So with eye tracking, though, you can allow the virtual reality device to mimic the nature of the eye and only render the part that the person is actually looking at. That leads to huge savings in computing power, battery life, which is one of the things that is going to allow eye tracking to be less tethered to kind of computers and make it actually a more consumer-friendly device. Also, for social uses, eye tracking is critical because it allows for much more natural social interactions. So without eye tracking, you have to turn your whole head to look at something in a different direction. But as we all know, that's not often the way people do things. They keep their head still while they move their eyes, etc. So if you want to have real natural feeling interactions in our virtual world, you need eye tracking so that people can have eye contact, can understand more social cues. And so it's one of these things wherein Toby, their technology actually really solves a major use case there. So in the near term, I think some parts of it are the kind of negatively impacted. Obviously, the pro business will probably suffer a little bit, and ideally they would be cash flow breakeven already, but they're still working. You know, the target is still the end of 2020, but obviously I think that'll probably be pushed back a little bit. And then they also have a little bit of the benefit from on the virtual reality and gaming computing. And also if people are working from home, the mainstream computing, a lot of the privacy and security features of eye tracking may be used on people's desktop computers as well. So they have some negatives and some positives. The stock is generally held by a lot of Swedish retail investors. It's actually very lightly held by foreign accounts. And so it tends to be a pretty volatile share. So it's dropped by almost 50% since the start of this coronavirus. And I think that is an overreaction based on the actual tangible impact to their business.
And on a portfolio level, I think you mentioned that you've deployed incremental cash. Is that right?
That is correct.
What's your take on kind of how, well, I guess we're not experts, so asking how long this is going to take is kind of a shot in the dark. But I guess we would agree that it is a temporary thing. So to what extent would you want to look at some businesses that are maybe really hard hit now, but where you feel like they will survive and you could potentially pick them up at some really juicy valuations?
So I'm of the belief that part of the reason you do work on ideas, even when you're not putting them on, is so that you're knowledgeable about things already when the crisis hits. I find it is very hard to get up to speed on new businesses in the middle of the crisis. So if you don't already understand the business going in, I find that generally when people are emotional and when greed and fear is reigning supreme, the analysis gets worse and the chances of making a mistake get significantly higher. So personally, I'm generally less interested in starting up new research projects in the middle of the crisis. But what I hope to do and what I've done is the companies that I've already researched in depth, that I feel like I have a good sense of their positive and negative attributes, those are the ones that I'm obviously keeping a very close eye on for entry points that I think are really attractive. And I think that at the top of that list, obviously, are the existing positions that are already in the portfolio. So, because those are the ones that generally you know even better than the ones on your watch list. So that's mostly what I've done. I have looked at a few different things, but as I mentioned at the beginning, the number of positions in the portfolio has shrunk by about 20%, I would say, and I've concentrated more in the names that I'm most interested in. And so the way that shrunk is I trimmed a few names that were kind of non-core or, I thought were more exposed or less interesting. And then I've added a couple names, but most of my increasing my exposure has been in the positions that I'm already interested in. That being said, there is some interest in terms of trying to get some exposure to some of these areas that have been the worst hit. And I'm a little bit reminded of something I did with my colleagues at Jay Goldman back when at my prior firm in 2008-2009, which we called at that point the survival basket, wherein this was December of 2008, and we created a list of companies where the share price had been incredibly hard hit, and there were some questions about their survival, and we made a basket of, I don't remember exactly, but I'd say it's probably roughly 20 names. with the argument being effectively that, you know, you did some really basic work to see if they had enough kind of room to survive and what they might be worth on normalized earnings, but you didn't do deep research on any of the names in the basket, and you assumed that you were probably going to be wrong a couple of times, and you might lose, you know, so let's say it's just with a 20-person position basket, you might lose, you know, 10% of that basket on the two positions that went to zero, but on the other 18, you'd make multiples of your money, and so the weighted return would be quite attractive. So that is something I've been considering, is, you know, some kind of, you know, distressed tourism, so aviation, hotels, et cetera, or distressed retail basket, which would allow for to get exposure without trying to get in depth up to speed on a business in the middle of the crisis, just because I think it's, frankly, it's almost a little too late for that, in my opinion.
Yeah, that's an interesting concept, some sort of a survival basket that would have multi-bagger upside.
Implicit in that is the assumption and the acceptance of the fact that you need to have a large enough basket that you can be wrong on a couple of these names, and a couple of these things will be materially impaired. But the idea is that if, you know, some portion of them survive, the one, you know, you can only have those positions go to zero, but the ones that survive can be multi-baggers, and that's kind of the way to think about it. So it has to have that acceptance that some number of these investments, you're not going to know which going in, are going to go to zero or something like zero.
Right. Interesting. Brad, how are you kind of staying sane and rational in this time? Have you changed your routine at all?
So I haven't. So I would say that, again, and this is actually a different point. Focusing on yourself and kind of making sure that you are mentally and physically healthy, I think, is of paramount importance in this kind of period. Everyone is going to be under increased stress. It's just natural when you have kind of big negative performance. The most important thing is to keep, you know, if you think of your mind and body as a machine, is to keep that machine well oiled and well taken care of. So the critical things are to make sure that you're first off to make sure you're getting plenty of sleep. I've actually, you know, moved my bedtime up kind of probably about an hour each night to make sure I'm getting adequate amount of rest. Also making sure that your diet is good. So I've been making sure that I take both immune supporting supplements as well as being really religious about taking the supplements that probably normally I only take about 80% of the time. Then the third thing I think is making sure to get some exercise. Sitting and staring at the screen all day, I think, can be actually a little bit counterproductive unless you really are a trader and you really need to. For longer-term investors, I think getting away from the screen, breaking a sweat, can be a really good way to reset your mental state. Because when, especially in a decline like this, which has been relatively unrelenting, except for a couple of really aggressive updates, for the most part, it's been pretty much straight line down. It can start to feel, I would say, you know, you can start to kind of maybe lose a little bit of your ability to remain emotionally distanced from your portfolio in the market. And I find that one of the best ways to regain that balance is to, you know, move out of the mental state and really into the physical state, wherein you are stressing your body, doing something you enjoy, or getting a good workout, wherein you focus purely physically for a bit and give your mind a break. So it's really taking care of yourself, I think, is critical, because this is a period where your mind and body are under significant stress, and so you need to be making sure that you keep it in the best shape possible.
Well, that's good advice, but I guess one glass of naked wines is okay.
No, I'm not, you know. Got to remember, red wine has lots of antioxidants, and it can be very beneficial in moderation.
Right. Good. Well, And maybe lastly, Brad, I'm wondering how you kind of try to make sure that your clients are on the same page, that they're kind of keeping a long-term mindset here.
And a little bit like the research, the answer to the research question, this is unfortunately, I think, work that has needed to have been done previously. So if you have spent your time cultivating the right client base for your style of investing and then educating them so that they understand your process and trust in your process, then this is the time I believe you get leeway. If you've either attracted a client base that is not the right fit for your style of investing or have not really spent the time with them previously to make sure that they fully understand what you're doing and trust your process, then in my opinion, it's already too late. No one is going to gain comfort in an investment process, in my opinion, in the middle of a crisis. They have to have that comfort previously, and they have to be the right fit for it. So if you haven't done the work already, it's kind of almost too late to start. But that being said, if you have laid the foundation, you obviously still need to maintain it. And this is a period wherein I think there's a lot of fear out there. A lot of people are worried about both their health and their wealth. And obviously, we can't do in our position as investment professionals, we can't do anything to help with their health necessarily. But with regards to making them comfortable with their wealth, you know, it's again reminding them what the process is, reminding them why you own what you own, being honest about positions wherein you've struggled, be honest about positions you have that might be exposed. And I find that this is a period wherein communication that reinforces the discussions you've already had can be really helpful. And also just remembering that sometimes people just want to talk, especially in this environment where a lot of people are staying at home and not having their normal social outlets. Just kind of being able to have a conversation and talk with people about what they're concerned about, both when you're talking to your investors and to other people broadly, can be really helpful for just returning people to some of that social connection that I think we're starting to miss a little bit as, you know, these kind of quarantines are taking hold.
Well, that's a really helpful perspective. Brad, thank you so much for taking the time to be here and share your insights, ideas, and wisdom with our members. We truly appreciate it.
And if you don't mind, John, I'd just like to make one more point. I think one thing that's important for all of us to remember in this period is, you know, we are incredibly lucky in that we can, we are getting to allocate capital for a living. And for most of us, while this has been a significant impact on our net worth, we all have some margin of safety to kind of, you know, to survive by. And keeping perspective about, you know, for those of us who are inconvenienced and being stuck in their homes, remembering that there are some people whose lives are legitimately at risk. For those of us who are concerned about our net worth falling a certain percentage, remembering that there are people who, who are going to be struggling to make rent this month. And looking for ways to help other people who are maybe going to be worse off than us. I find in periods where I'm in personal stress, remembering about those less fortunate and also actively trying to take the time to help them is both beneficial for them, but also incredibly beneficial for my psyche. So I would urge all members of the Manual of Ideas community to think about, think about those who are less fortunate than we are and think about the places where we can personally help, both for societal benefits and also for selfish benefits. So that would be my final thought.
Well, that's a great point. Thank you so much. And I also want to wish you and your family all the very best in this period.
No, absolutely, John. It's been great to chat. Wish you the best of luck. Stay safe. And, you know, we will get through this and then we'll, you know, be interesting to see where we're at on the other side.
Absolutely. Thank you so much, Brad. Take care.
Okay. Have a great day.
Bye.